you were saying that in the department there was different factions amongst the faculty.
I mean, the only person, interesting enough, who was outside that was Bob McKenzie, who may be a name that's no longer remembered, but he had a kind of triple role. He was an interesting political sociologist. He was a Canadian and a professor of political sociology. He was had a very prominent role in the BBC and always kind of chaired the election night programmes. He was the inventor of the swingometer, which was a piece of cardboard with a hand on it. And he was a gay man. And he was sufficiently outside, as it were, the little incestuous, tight, claustrophobic world of LSE. And he was much more objective, and he didn't play those games. But there were insiders, and the inside professors, fought over size of rooms and secretaries. I mean, in the days when there were secretaries, who had, you know, which secretary and who had most of her time is always a her. And it was petty, really. But I mean, it was quite disagreeable. And it percolated down. My first tutor when I was an undergraduate was a man who obviously got on very badly with one of those grand professors, and he tried to make me recognise the distinction between a normative and a descriptive statement, prescriptive and descriptive. And he said, "Look, I'm going to say a number of sentences, and tell me whether it's normative or prescriptive. Professor Glass is a liar. Professor Glass is a bully. Professor Glass is," you know, and he went, reeled it on. He was obviously, you know, very, very bitter about the way in which he'd been treated. So
that must have been interesting coming from a more criminology. You're sort of studying people's...
Well, that was much later. That turned out much later. And I studied criminology, as I said, largely by accident. But the accounts that I encountered, particularly from America, were very colourful. They were kind of an anthropology of the streets, a lot of quotation, a lot of photographic evidence. And I found them much more enthralling than, for example, the grand theory that was being taught on the one hand, very high Weberian, Marxist, Durkheimian theory, or the kind of blue book Fabianism, which was very much the hallmark of the school, an obsession then, and I probably would believe now, with things like social mobility, you know, how, you know, and the way in which class inhibited life chances and all that. And it was a kind of an obsessive attention to the limits on mobility and the way in which schooling had an impact upon people's prospects. And I found that very arid, to be honest. And maybe I shouldn't have, but I did. And suddenly to be plunged into, you know, accounts of American cops and delinquents on the, you know, delinquent gangs and, you know, brothels in Chicago. What my man with a wonderful name, Reckless, called Vice in Chicago. And I just thought this was wonderful, you know. So that's why I became a criminologist.
What were the students seem like to teach? How did you find the students?
At what period? Because it changed over the decades. Almost invariably, they were bright. They were engaged. With two exceptions over a very long period of time, because I kind of, you know, served my full term before the mast of 4 decades. I only had two people who were at all difficult, obstreperous. One was an American student who'd been through Vietnam and I think was suffering from PTSD. And another one was somebody who was very troubled, I think, by sexual identity and got into it. But they were, I hate to use the word, almost deferential. You know, they somehow accepted the authority of the role. I found them very, very pleasurable. I mean, the trouble with undergraduates, of course, is that they tend to disappear very rapidly from view. They kind of, you know, you see them in October and by May, effectively, they've disappeared. So there's a very short time span And in classes, even though there was a fully fledged tutorial system when I began, you know, 1-to-1 or 1-to-2, you didn't really get to know them very well. The greater, I think, engrossment was with research students. And I had a large number of them, as almost anybody in this institution would have done, 50, 60 PhD students over the years. And some of them are still friends. Wednesday on Monday, I met two former students for lunch, and that's very common. It's like it was almost like a family connection. These are kind of, as it were, you know, surrogate family, and you build up a friendship over a very long period of time, and you watch them develop. And for them, I think coming to the LSE, doing a doctorate, is a very transformative experience. You know, they mature, they find it exciting, they start finding a voice, and there's a lot of what I think the analysts would call transference. You know, they, as it were, impart an awful lot of their pleasure to their supervisor. You know, they attribute, and it's not really that, but I mean, you know, the bonds become quite close. And that was the greatest thing. And I learned a lot from the students, inevitably, because they were, you know, exploring really quite original areas of inquiry. And, you know, spending time with them and so on, you are educated too. What I could do with a PhD student was almost talk to younger colleagues and deal very loosely with questions of method and protocol. And I always used to think that they have linear time. In other words, every event supersedes every other event in a way that is unfamiliar. Where for the supervisor, it's cyclical time. You've been through it before. You know what's going to follow. It's repetitive. So, you know, you've got that kind of wisdom of experience. But that was the chief joy, I think, really. And this is and was very heavily a graduate institution. And the graduates, I think, are, as it were, instrumental in framing the culture of the place.
So, basically you're saying that one of the highlights of being here at LSE was teaching the graduates.
Yes.
And working with the graduates through
yes.
the PhDs and the masters. And what would be, like, the other main highlights of being here at LSE?
Well, if I could just add to that, I mean, it is much more difficult, I found, as a teacher, to talk to an 18 or a 19-year-old about themes, ideas, which are utterly unfamiliar to them, because there is a gulf and you have to kind of bring them on. It's not so much a matter of conversation as instruction, whereas with graduate students, you know, what you're doing is bringing people who are already fairly well-formed along a little further. You said, what were the highlights?
Yeah, what are the main achievements that have stuck out in your mind?
Well, it's a very febrile place. I mean, it because of it where it is, because of its reputation, almost everybody who is interesting passes through it at some point. So there is an extraordinary effervescence, continual effervescence of seminars, lectures, visitors, which I think is very, very important. I spent time in a teaching as a visiting professor in, you know, the last part of my career in an Ivy League school in one semester a year for a number of years in the States. And it didn't have that buzz. You had very distinguished professors, but they were sequestered in their own offices. There wasn't a sense of a collective or a collegial life as there is. And I think that exists here. And to pursue that further, I've always found that the people I worked with were extraordinarily, I've used the word collegial, I mean, they were good colleagues, friends. If I asked them to do something, I assumed always that they would say yes, and vice versa. It was very helpful that if I was drafting papers, that they would read them and comment on them. So there was a continual interchange. In the American university where I was, I had a student who attacked positivism, a graduate student, rather fiercely, and I thought rather naively. So I sent him to a colleague, a very distinguished empirical statistician, to talk about positivism, because I said it's not as foolish as you imagine it might be. And the colleague turned him away and said, I don't talk about philosophy with students. So I would know. I don't think I would ever experience that here. So it's collegiality, and it was a transcended departments. I mean, I had as much in the way of interaction with people in the departments of social policy and law and psychology as in sociology. There was a kind of network of us which we formalized as something called the Mannheim Center. It was named after a man called Herman Mannheim, who was a very distinguished criminologist who came here in the mid-1930s, was a refugee from Nazi Germany. And it was a virtual institution, as we call it. And I thought highly successful. I mean, it didn't have much of a space. It now has a room, but I mean, it didn't have much of a space. It didn't have independent recognition for research ref purposes, but it annealed us together. And the thing about the school, as I'm sure other people have said, is that it's small enough and compact enough and dense enough for people to continually collide with one another. And there is a lot of conversation going on. One of the most important institutions, I think, is the dining room. You know, it's a little elitist, and a lot of universities gave up. I mean, Essex, I think, gave up having a separate dining facilities for staff. But it meant that you went to the dining room and you got involved with conversations, and you would make, you know, arrangements to meet people for lunch. So there's a running conversation with colleagues that goes on all the time, and the endless little encounters in corridors and so on, which is enormously, I think, enormously productive. I mean, it generates, you know, endless little ideas. I mean, I went to the library today and met somebody who, curiously enough, I'd shared a staircase with in Oxford, and we were graduate students together, David Soskus, who is now very distinguished, not a millennial professor, but something professor here. And we had an interesting conversation, you know, just en passant, which is very much the school. Whereas I think in larger campus universities, the relationships are much more attenuated as a result.
Were you involved in any staff activities or staff groups? Like you mentioned the staff dining room.
Well, we set up the Mannheim Centre, as I said, which was a cross-departmental disciplinary group. I've always been a very kind of boring, you know, conventional academic. I've been interested in ideas, interested in discussing ideas with people. We did various things together. We set up, you know, co-edited a series of books and with the Oxford University Press and so on. But I mean, nothing kind of untoward or unusual. I have a young colleague now whom I met in the States, who's now in the law department, and she's done all sorts of things like set up running groups, and you know, that's not me, I'm afraid.
Working too hard.
What?
You've been working instead.
Well, I'm not working too hard, but also I had a family and children and all that, so my life was, you know, full. Without, it's a very odd, contradictory institution. On the one hand, I've always found it very friendly and very gemütlich, you know. But it is a metropolitan college, and people travel in from great distances across a large catchment area. So there isn't a huge amount of socializing outside in the outside, you know, work hours. I have what I regard as reasonably close friendships, but haven't necessarily visited other people's houses, for example, or spend an awful lot of time going to the theatre or doing things like that with them. So it's a kind of compartmentalised pool of friendliness, but doesn't swamp out as it might do in Oxford or Cambridge or other places.
A lot of other people have said the same thing.
Yeah, and it's not disagreeable, you know.
It's very centralised.
Yes.
You mentioned like positives, the sexual violence, the graduate students, the colleagues, and it's all been very positive. What do you think have been the main challenges that you faced here at LSE?
I think in many ways, professionally, I had a bit of a charmed life. I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, I started here as an assistant lecturer. I got a bit disgruntled in kind of mid-career, feeling I'll never get promoted. And, you know, my, what was it, early 40s, late 30s, but promotion did come. And I got, first of all, a personal chair than an established chair. And I had absolutely no reason to complain about anything, I think. I mean, things may have changed a bit since I retired, and I've been writing about it a little because I contributed a chapter to a handbook of criminology, and I was asked to, you know, consider the future of the discipline. And there are all sorts of rather depressing things going on. I mean, there's the way in which raising money for research is now regarded as a laudable end in its own right rather than instrumental in promoting, you know, inquiry. The way in which we're supposed, but I don't think the LSE drives its staff to compliance, we're supposed to, you know, promote, you know, the economy, social mobility, and all sorts of things, rather than just follow our noses and, you know, pursue things out of intellectual curiosity. But I've always found it a very free environment. I remember talking to somebody who was either in head of or senior in research and consultancy, I don't know if it's still called that, called Gus Stewart, who was a lovely man. And I said I'd been asked, you know, to take part in a bid for large-scale funding for research on a particular project. What shall I do? And he said, if it's something you want to do and it'll promote, you know, interests that you have, go for it. But if it's just to please the school or the department, don't bother. And I thought that that was, you know, admirable advice. I really did, and it seemed to me, at least at the time I was here, to be very characteristic of the school. It's, you know, it's an old-fashioned, scholarly sort of place. And we had, I think, reasonable time to write and do research. Towards the end of my career, the sabbatical system, I don't know if it still prevails, but was generous. I don't know what it's like now. I mean, some people have to scrabble for time out to do research in other universities, but at least LSE in my years, you know, afforded one time, and that got a little bit of the kind of any sense of cabin fever, if that's the right phrase, I might have had. I mean, I spent a year in Canada writing about Canadian criminal justice. I had a very good year in Princeton teaching. I spent time in Australia, Australian National University, and all that was made possible with the sabbatical system. I spent a year in Wood Green, you know, which looking at the Crown Court, and I always felt that there was, as it were, room to work and do research, and you know, it was always imperative for me to have some sort of interesting research project on hand, and I felt I had the liberty to do it. So that's something I'm grateful to. In this institution too. Mind you, I have a very limited experience. I've never taught in another British university. I've taught in Canadian and American universities, but so I really don't know how special LSE is in that regard. We do have gossip with colleagues, and I think some places are better off. I think Oxford treats its people better. Some places are far, far worse off than LSE. It's becoming much more ritzier, much more glitzy. It was dowdy when I started, as I said. It's now, particularly with the rebuilding that's going on, going to look increasingly dramatic, architecturally adventurous. I mean, you know, rather, I think the new building plans are very beautiful. There are anxieties, I believe, in gossiping to colleagues, because even if one retires, one comes in and, you know, one's on a kind of semi-detached grapevine, you know, you don't know all the gossip, but you get some sense of what's going on. There are anxieties about whether the LSE is overcommitting itself financially at the moment, and whether it might be riding for a fall, because university financing is always precarious, and particularly at the moment when Theresa May is being careful about restricting university entry, and LSE, I think, is heavily dependent on overseas students, both as a form of intellectual diversity, but also for economic reasons. I remember when the so-called Asian tigers, the little tigers, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, were undergoing hard times financially, and there was a real fear at the LSE that the institution might go bankrupt simply because, you know, there would be a sudden dearth of students from that part of the world. It didn't happen. But so it strikes me as this, you know, it's a little risky at the moment. It's certainly becoming very, very much more cosmopolitan than when I was, you know, here right at the beginning. I mean, it was very solidly English, white, middle class then. There are gender transformations. I mean, it's now becoming very much more, the academy is becoming much more feminized, which is, you know, all to the good. I mean, it's, you know, I think that's a very marked feature, both at the student and at the faculty level. I was editor of what is in effect a school journal, although it's quite distinguished, the British Journal of Sociology, for a while, and almost as a kind of political gesture, I appointed some women to the board, and it was the first time they'd ever had women. And there was a lot of crustiness about it. So, I mean, all that seems to me has changed. I do worry about the directions where government is taking us. As I said, that we seem to be what ministry do we come under? The Department of Business and Skills. You know, once upon a time is the Department for Education. The idea of open inquiry is in peril. And I was having this conversation with colleagues at lunch. If there is no place, I mean, there must be a place where thought should be free of the market. And if it's not the universities, I don't know where it is. And I think the market is encroaching very dangerously. And it's enticing. I mean, a lot of my former colleagues are being paid very substantial sums of money, you know, they're much, much larger than it. The differentials are huge. Research grant funding can be really very substantial, but there's a tremendous price to pay. A friend of mine who's not here but in Wolverhampton talked about it as a Faustian bargain. You know, when you accepted the massive expansion of universities with government funding, you become enthralled to the government. And I think that is really quite worrying. And I used to be brought up with the belief that the state was benign, but I'm not sure it is. And I think independence from the state is desirable. And to that extent, it was refreshing teaching in an Ivy League university, a private university, which didn't depend upon the kind of very tight regulatory regime which the state imposes. I remember reading a book called The California Earth Controversy, which is about the bad old days in the 1950s when American academics were required to swear a loyalty oath, and the state universities all capitulated and the private universities did not. And it seems to me we have too little, as it were, distance from the state. You know, there is a risk. Well, if you look at the websites, as I said, I was updating a chapter for a handbook, and if you look at the websites, the Department for Justice, which is a funder in my area, the ESRC, Economic and Social Research Council, if you look at the Department for Business and Skills, it's all about Nuffield Foundation. It's all about servicing the economy, social engineering, social mobility, addressing certain policy problems within society, and you won't get funding from any of those bodies if you don't comply. And that it's not that you're being told what conclusions to reach, but you're certainly being pointed very heavily at what are called thematic priorities, which are not, you know, driven by scholars in an old-fashioned sense. And I think that's bad. I think there's scope for both, but it worries me. And I imagine that, I don't know what the position is at the school at the moment. We have some very fine departments. For example, anthropology was always small, but, you know, very interesting, very distinguished people. I don't know what place it's supposed to occupy in that new, you know, that brave new world.
Subjects that perhaps are, as you say, scholarly subjects, knowledge, education, study, but not always applicable to the present day.
Absolutely. It's not going to promote economic growth, which seems to be their overriding imperative. And I suspect that LSE pays quite a lot of lip service to that and tries to ride it out. But the pressures must be enormous. I remember an earlier director, John Ashworth, asking heads of department, I was a head of department for a while, not a very good one, but what are, you know, the chief priorities of the LSE? And people said, oh, it's the promotion of research and transmission of culture and the training of young minds. And he said, no, the first priority is solvency. And I suspect that is, you know, still the case, and it's worrying. What, in conjunction, apropos of John Ashworth?
No, about the future of LSE being much more about financial priorities than colony priorities.
I mean, if I may go on with that, I mean, there are people who seem to me to be swimming against the tide, is that the expression, against the current. I mean, we have a very, very fine law department, and curiously enough, I have more to do with it now. I go to their seminars and know the people teaching there, and it's not strictly vocational. I mean, it seems to me an intellectually extremely interesting place with a lot of diversity, and they're not just training people for the bar and for the, you know, the city. They are, you know, they engage in open-minded inquiry of a very high order. And I, you know, I just hope that that kind of resilience can remain.
So we've actually covered a lot of what I'm asking you about. What I was going to ask you about. Is there anything in light of everything that you said and everything we've talked about? Is there anything that you feel like that I haven't asked you about?
Well, there is one thing that strikes me, and that is simply because of accident, my prime interest was in studying policy making. And I spent quite a lot of time sitting in meetings in government and interviewing ministers and policy officials, reading papers and all that. And LSE is in an extraordinarily fortunate position. I mean, if you think of its location, it has a reputation. So that it's something of a kind of an open sesame for a lot of academics, but it's within walking distance of Whitehall, it's within walking distance of Westminster, it's within the walking distance of the Law Courts, it's within the walking distance of the British Library, and that kind of geographical location at the very centre of things, I think, is absolutely absolutely paramount. And everything is within reach. I mean, the thing I've been doing and still just finishing off is with two colleagues at LSE is an official history for the Cabinet Office. And the Cabinet Office is just, you know, within reach. And if I want to do an interview with a minister and the former minister like Patrick Mayhew or in the House of Lords, it's within reach. I've sometimes been, you know, flirted with the idea that, you know, in another incarnation I'll emerge as a professor at Oxford or Cambridge because the architecture is so beautiful. But it is so much easier to do that kind of work here, and I'm sure it's true of the economists who, you know, are interested in the city, for example, with the Bank of England on tap and all the bigger financial institutions and the lawyers and everybody else. It's an extraordinary venue. Right here, there was a talk once upon a time of us uplifting ourselves and going to Croydon, I think. And, you know, one imagines what that would have been like. So that is a huge advantage, absolutely vast. I don't know how appreciated it is, but it's extraordinary. I mean, the disadvantage, of course, of being in London is it's difficult to retain junior colleagues. I've got no idea how they manage to afford to live in London. And that is going to be a real problem. If you talk about the future of the LSE, that, I think, is going to be a besetting, slow, smouldering crisis. I mean, I have a young friend, a colleague, who has arrived here, and half her income goes on renting a one-bedroom flat. And I don't think, unless, you know, she wins the proverbial lottery, she'll ever, you know, be able to buy a place. And it's deeply worrying, because people can't really set up a long-term commitment to the place.
Do you think that also affects not just the faculty, but affects almost anybody at any level who work at the school?
Of course.
So,
the
administrators and the people that keep the school running from behind the scenes.
I mean, there are people who've developed rather extravagant solutions to that problem. I was at Palo Alto in California on the Stanford campus, and Stanford is in the middle of Silicon Valley, and that is probably some of the most expensive property in the world. I don't know if it's more expensive than London, but it's certainly on a par with it. What Stanford has done is developed its own portfolio of real estate, and faculty can buy real estate on the Stanford campus, but it's covenanted. They cannot sell to anyone other than Stanford faculty. That obviously, I mean, Stanford is a very, very wealthy institution, but you know, it's that kind of solution, I think, that, you know, is required. Otherwise, people are just stymied. I mean, I don't know how on earth young faculty without capital can afford to live in this place.
Or people like PhD students.
Indeed, absolutely.
Postgraduate, master's
students. Although we're quite well off, aren't we, for residential accommodation for students, I don't know. Yeah, quite.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like?
No. Was that all right?
That's good.